Welcome to EduMeasure, a podcast for teachers, students, parents, and others concerned with transforming teaching and learning, a podcast for exploring creative, unconventional responses to current issues in education. I'm your host, Bernd Esterbrook, a professor at a small liberal arts college in Illinois. I am going to be interviewing Dr. Edward Leonard. Go ahead, Ed, and tell us a little bit about who you are and where you come from.
Well, thank you, Bernd. I'm glad to be here on the EduMeasure podcast. So my background is that I grew up in a Jesuit education and believe that it was important to seek social justice and human welfare. And then I went to law school and had all of that mixed up in my head. So in order to continue, I decided I really wanted to be a teacher. And I stepped back from law and went to graduate school and earned a PhD in radio, television, film. And since then, I've been primarily a classroom teacher in a university setting. I've taught at a number of universities, including the City University of New York, the University of Washington, and most recently at the University of San Francisco.
I should say here for our listeners that Ed and I have been engaged in a long-term discussion of education and related matters for I think it's about 44 years now. And to some extent, we can predict what each other is going to say, but we still manage to surprise one another once in a while. So I'm hoping for some of those surprises now. And so what I'd like to do is to have Ed take several questions, sort of general questions that apply to the subject matter of this podcast, and see what he can do with those. So I'm going to start off, Ed, with the first question. How is what you are teaching or what you are having your students do transformational?
Well, that's an excellent question and invokes the most recent class that I had the privilege to create and implement at the University of San Francisco. It's called San Francisco Law and Order. And what it is, it's a seminar directed at first-year students. And these college students who have not yet been in college come to my class and they are expected in the seminar to participate and learn. It's not a lecture class and it's not a criminal justice class. It's closer to a sociology class. And so the students come in and they are unfamiliar with the idea of empirical evidence. And the class begins and focuses on using what you see and hear and observe as the basis for your opinions about what is true and what is false. So in the class, in the short version of the explanation, on Tuesdays, we go down to court in San Francisco and observe hearings, trials, and sentencings. And on Thursdays, we talk about what we saw, heard, and observed, and then discuss the movies and television that we are simultaneously with these field trips watching and discuss what is the relationship between the mediated portrayal of law and justice in the United States and what you can see actually by being in the courtroom with your own eyes and ears.
Clearly, I can say that the ideal you are expressing here is one that we could all share. I'm curious, to what degree is this ideal, the purpose and the plans, the pedagogy of this course, to what degree can it be realized? Is it realized? And how transformational is it in the actual experience of your students?
Well, let's begin with the assumption that directly experiencing reality without your filters is a transformational experience. So much of what we must do in the class is peel away your assumptions and your filters and your prior prejudices and understandings about how the courtroom actually works. And so by seeing and hearing with your own eyes and experiencing the day-to-day reality in a San Francisco courtroom, it is essentially transformational because your prior preconceptions are being adjusted or in some cases refuted by the actual reality you experience.
That makes sense. All right. Well, then question number two, what's the most important thing your students take with them when they leave your classroom or course? What are the residual effects? What is it that they can bring out into their own world and use in one way or another?
That's a good question, and it assumes that I have been successful. And that's not always true. So assuming that my teaching and learning in the seminar have been successful, the students will come out with a increased understanding of the interrelated complexity of the real world. And they will see that any part that they see doesn't stand right. by itself, right. but is instead intimately tied to other elements and working institutions. And that to understand the entire picture is a humbling and powerful experience, because you begin to see the wheels of society turn. So I would say that is the ultimate goal, is to not come to the class with a theoretical understanding, but rather come to the class with a clean mind, with a blank slate, and then build your understanding of how the world works from your own observations and analysis, rather than trying to fit reality into a pre-established, preconceived framework.
Okay, and the big question, again, this being a remarkable and I think wonderful ideal, how do you know that this has actually taken place? In other words, the question of assessment.
Yes. Well, again, the primary way one would determine this is through qualitative methods. There really aren't any quantitative testing or things that would allow you to do this. For example, I could have a multiple choice test that would ask you to correctly identify each stage of the criminal justice system and what rights applied to each defendant at each moment. But that's simply memorization and repetition back to me. What really matters is your understanding. And as we've discussed in our prior discussions to this podcast, that context is knowledge. And so what we're really working with these young students, these freshmen, first-year students, is understanding the context for knowledge and how you as an investigator, using yourself as your evidence, your own impressions and your own engagement with reality becomes your evidence. What do you now think? So you ask students in assessment to do what is called reflective practice. And so you ask them to consider what were their ideals and ideas and assumptions at the beginning of the class about justice and how justice was achieved inside an institutional context like a court system. And then you ask them, now that you've been through 15 weeks and you've had the chance to observe, what has stayed the same and what has changed? And the answers that I get from the students are deeply revealing and unquestionably confirm that some of the educational objectives with some of the students, some of the time, have been fully achieved.
How do you feel about this in the current framework of how our education is situated at your institution and elsewhere? What degree of success can you say you've achieved in this goal? How many students in the class are going to, at least to some degree, demonstrate what you've described here?
Well, again, it depends. And part of the problem is that there is some mismatch between the ambition of the class and the experience, training, and skills of the freshman students. Probably, of course, it would be better suited for juniors or seniors, but that is not how I am given the privilege of teaching only 15 students for a semester where we go on field trips for half of the days. So there's an institutional element where this class is a recruitment tool for the university. They say, if you come to the University of San Francisco, in your first year, you'll be given the option of participating in a small class led by a professor. And we will, you know, so there's many, many first-year seminars, which mine is only one of. So institutionally, it is part of a programmatic way to introduce students to university life. And this is, I'm just one of the classes.
Part of the issue here that we are, it's implicit in what we're discussing, has to do with the ideal versus the real, with what we would like to do, what we believe is necessary, and what we can actually accomplish in the classroom. So can you, you've already implied a few of these, but I'd like to hear about what is the single most important obstacle or challenge to the kind of excellent teaching you're talking about and the kind of learning that we are aiming for in today's educational environment?
As usual, the most important obstacles are, the interface between the teaching and the learning. That's where the obstacles arise. And each learner is different. And each learner learns in a different style and comes to class with different assumptions and backgrounds. And this is not to answer your question, but just to give you an example, I had a computer scientist major, and his perspectives on how things were carried out and organized were, of course, very different than some of the other students who were more of a traditional liberal arts. Let's take your question again in parts. What is the first part?
So the most important obstacle or challenge to the kind of teaching you're talking about, the one that you know you have to surmount in order to be able to accomplish your goal.
Okay, so number one is me as the teacher making the effort to get to know each of the students as an individual. That is the biggest obstacle. And the obstacle comes from two areas. One, my own reticence and lack of incentive to do this. This is a time-consuming process and is not necessarily rewarding. There's no benefit to me that I get externally. There is no reward system that says you will be rewarded for this. And on the flip side, the students are often playing their cards very close to their chest and will not show what their true assets are and what their true liabilities are as a student. So, for example, among first-year students, many students have a fundamental inability to follow directions. Have you experienced that?
Absolutely.
So this is so basic, but you know, some of the students, if you spell something out, they comply and progress and improve. And other students simply are unable to carry out a sequence of instructions. So for example, I begin my assignments by saying, please put your name at the top of the paper. Have you had that experience?
Oh, I have a running joke where I talk about the extraordinary grade that Mr. or Ms. Anonymous has in my class because they get the grade because if you don't put your name on the paper, I don't know who you are.
Yeah, so this obstacle of being able to carry out the procedures necessary for learning are greatly amplified in the real world. For example, my students had to get up at 7:30 in the morning, get on the bus or other transit to get down to the courtroom by 8:30. And some of the students remarked what a transformational experience this was to have this obligation to get up, put on ordinary street clothes, you know, court clothes, and then be ready to interact with the real world at 8:30 in the morning. This was totally new for the students who have spent most of their lives in protected educational institutions.
I'd like to backtrack a little bit on something you said a few moments ago about reward. And I want to argue with you here on this one, because I think that the saying there is no reward, I think you need to define what you mean by reward, because to my mind, one of the rewards is that when you get to know the students individually, you're establishing a relationship which in and of itself is rewarding. And I would imagine you'd say the same thing, but I'd be curious what you mean by reward. I think you mean institutional rewards, or could you clarify?
Well, let's just assume that if I wished to, as an adjunct, I must say that I'm teaching not as a full member of the University of San Francisco faculty, but rather as a person who is for hire, meaning I may be, I have no security of employment, and I may be reemployed or not reemployed right at the wishes of my dean. So any investment I make in the institution is contingent on my being renewed as a teacher and being renewed as a teacher in the context where my prior efforts and energies have been preserved and somehow rewarded. So if I'm teaching introduction to media studies and then I'm asked to teach quantitative analysis, there's very little carryover between the two. And the same goes for the students, that I am not likely to see the students again. So the students will be with me for a semester and there is almost zero chance I will encounter them in a second course. So in that sense, whatever happens, happens only in that 15 weeks. I will not likely have a chance to interact with the students again, which is different than my experience when I was full-time professor at institutions. And I still am in touch with some of my students after 25 years who now have children of their own and are sending their children to college. So, yeah, the reward as a adjunct professor is different than as a full professor or a permanent professor, because my efforts in getting to know my students is only intrinsically rewarded. There is no moment where I get any extrinsic reward for it. And what's more, given the fact that my salary is $900 a month at the University of San Francisco as an adjunct instructor, there's an incentive for me to preserve my energies and abilities for other remunerative activities that are required to earn enough money to pay the rent in San Francisco.
Well, you've raised a number of issues here that I would love to continue on with, but we're reached the end of our session today, and I think we'll be talking about this in the future. In particular, I think the ways in which the institutional framework necessarily impinges upon some of our highest ideals in the classroom. So I want to thank Dr. Leonard very much for today's conversation.
Thank you for having me on the EduMeasure podcast, and I look forward to hearing more episodes from you.
Thanks for listening, and we will see you soon.